Okay. The Day of Atonement is, see, it's pointing to two things. First of all, our legal atonement to God. And then second of all, our experiential atonement to God. We have to understand that we're not yet saved experientially. That is, we're not in His presence with glorified bodies. We are saved legally, and we're saved provisionally. Now, none of those are, in a certain sense, I probably shouldn't say it quite that way, but it's not like we can find verses in the Bible that say there's legal salvation, there's provisional salvation, there's experiential salvation. But that is really what it amounts to. And when he says, now is come salvation in Revelation 12:10, that's experiential. And the kind of salvation we have right now, it isn't right to just say, well, I'm legally saved right now. No, I'm experientially saved in the sense that if I die right now, I am saved. It's not just a legal thing as though there's no benefits, there's nothing being reaped from it, there's no change. It's just like I have salvation, but it's just kind of this whatever, and it's not really doing anything for me. It is doing something for me, just like it's doing something for you. But it's still being contested, and there's still steps that I have to take. And so in an overall sense, it's a legal salvation, and with these provisions, it will become experiential. Well, that's all involved here with the Day of Atonement. He's talking about it in a legal sense as well as an experiential one. And the thing about the experiential is that it is to be happening along the way. It isn't to just stay legal and then when we go to heaven it becomes experiential. He wants more and more an experiential at-one-ment to be occurring in our lives between Him and us. You can also note Romans 8, verses 23 to 25. And Philippians chapter 3, verses 13 and 14. And there are a lot of different things stated in such a way that it is very clear that he's talking about legal, provisional, and experiential. We're mainly using those terms for convenience. They get the point across very, very well. Somebody, I suppose, would argue and say, well, it's like you're making three different kinds of salvation. We're not making three different kinds of salvation. I am saved. I am saved this very moment. My name is written in the Lamb's Book of Life. It's not partially written there. God isn't still thinking about writing it there. It is there. I'm saved. But overall, it's still in a legal sense because I'm still not in heaven. Earth is not heaven. Heaven is an entirely different place than planet Earth. And I want to get there. And it's not once saved, always saved. There are conditions, there are provisions, there are steps that must be taken. When we compare Aaron with Christ, we can make these kind of comparisons. Number one, Aaron offers this first goat. He offers it. But with Christ, what he does is he offers himself. Aaron offers a goat, Christ offers himself. The goat is the animal of identification. It shows Christ's full identification with man. He's not this goat. He isn't the one who has sinned. He's not dying to take care of his own sin. But he's doing it in identification with us. So Aaron offers his first goat. Christ offers himself. The second point is that Aaron enters the Holy of Holies. Well, Christ didn't enter the Holy of Holies. He entered heaven. He went to the true Holy of Holies. That's what he did. He entered it. The third thing is that Aaron then came out of the Holy of Holies. He comes forth. This is exactly what Christ is going to do. He's going to do this at the rapture. That's what it's signifying. He's coming forth. He's coming out. He's offered this animal. That's Aaron. Christ offered himself. Then he enters the Holy of Holies. Christ entered heaven. But then they both come out. And what Aaron does is he sends this scapegoat away. When he comes out, he then does what shows sin being fully removed. Just totally removed. It's gone. It's pointing to a time when sin is gone. That sounds positively delightful. That sounds really good. There is a time when Christ comes and He is going to put sin away forever by taking us to be with Him. See, it's put away forever. The scapegoat is sent away. That's sin being put away. It's completely removed. It's gone. There is a time when sin will be totally gone. Now, I don't know how much that is really going to happen prior to the rapture. I don't know what kind of lives we're actually going to be living as we're walking more and more in a closeness with God, a surrender, an openness, a yieldedness, experiencing God, being partakers of the divine nature, manifestation of the sons of God, all these different kinds of things. I don't know what it's going to be like exactly. I think there's going to be a tremendous experiential righteousness. I think there's going to be a very pronounced overcoming of sin, of really being overcomers. Whether that's somehow where we're perfect, I don't know. I have my doubts. I have my reservations. Maybe that'd be a better way of saying that. But whatever the case really is, at the rapture, it's going to be done. And sin will be put away forever. And there will be nothing to ever separate us again from Christ and from the Father. And see, that's what sin does. Sin is this thing that keeps separating us from God. And God, it really isn't to be viewed that God is he's just upset about sin. He's got this thing against sin. That misses the point. The point is, He wants us. He doesn't want things blocking His desire for us to keep being thwarted. So He's got this desire for us. Now, to me, that's just totally incomprehensible. I just think, you've got to be kidding. You mean He really wants us? Yes. That's amazing. That is really incredible. So, see, this is why He's dealing with sin, because sin is what blocks us, hinders us, keeps us away from Him, separates us from Him. He's wanting to get sin removed. It's not because, in this sense, it's just like, He just hates wrong. He's like this perfectionist that just wants everything done right for the sake of having everything done right. See, that misses what His heart really is. He's not this kind of guy who just wants everything in place. Just, come on, now get everything in order. Come on, will you just do it right one time? Come on, just get everything where it should be. Just do it right. He just wants to see it done right. See, that's not His heart. That's not the way He is. He's not like some sort of a drill sergeant. Everybody's got to have their shoes polished, or they got to have all this lined up, and the tie's got to be just this way, and then the coat's got to be this way, and you got to stand this way, and it's just like, and then He's satisfied. And then He just says, good job, men, you're dismissed. And it just, it's so satisfying to God's heart. That's not satisfying to God's heart. That isn't what He wants. He wants the hearts of the people. He wants our heart. That's what He wants. He's dealing with sin because He wants our heart. That's what He's doing. And that's really, really a significant thing. All of this is to put sin away so we can be His. He wants us. He's trying to get us to Him. He wants us. Ongoing, eternal relationship between us and Himself. And sin is what keeps standing in the way. All sorts of sins. Every kind of sin. And it keeps us from doing what we know to do. We end up doing what we don't want to do. It just goes on and on and on and on. But God is working to really provide, through His whole plan, a true at-one-ment. that is experiential in every respect. And I think when you say experiential in every respect, I just don't think that's really going to happen down here. I think it's going to be experiential to a large degree down here. And I think we're going to be able to really walk in the Spirit. And I think we're going to be amazed at what it's really like to walk in the Spirit. And I think we'll find that maybe what we have described as walking in the Spirit hasn't been so much walking in the Spirit. I think we're really going to know Him and experience His power and His presence. I think there are these phenomenal things that are awaiting us still down here that will produce a tremendous at-one-ment with God. But as far as an at-one-ment in every respect, I think that's only going to be in heaven. I don't think we're going to walk exactly like Christ walked. Now, if we do, fine. I'll be happy to walk that way. But I'd be glad to be wrong. I'd be glad to have my opinion changed. I know the Scriptures say some really powerful and tremendous things, and I don't mean to cast any unbelief on those things, but I just don't know what it's going to be like exactly. And you can, I don't mean to not believe certain things, but I do know you can put certain things out here and you can count on certain things where you kind of went way beyond, in a sense, what it was going to be like, and then it's just constant disappointment. I don't think God wants us to live with constant disappointment. But at the same time, He doesn't want us back here under constant skepticism and doubt and fear. I think we have to say, well, it could be this. We might be able to live this way. I know it's going to be a tremendous thing, but exactly what that amounts to and what it'll actually become, it's difficult to say. It's hard to assess. And I don't want to take anything away from what God is saying. And there's going to be differing opinions on it. I think it's going to be a tremendous thing. The moves of God that are still ahead of us are going to be tremendous. But I don't think that and I know this is true, that no matter what our relationship becomes here with God, it won't compare in the slightest with what it is when we're in glorified bodies, in His presence in heaven. There'll be no comparison. It will change dramatically. We'll know we're in heaven. We won't say, well, this is just like it was on earth. It won't be just like it was on earth. And we'll do a lot more than just dancing about. It'll be a little bit more than that song. It'll be a little bit more depth to it than that. I like that song, but I don't think it really represents heaven very well, personally. You can note Hebrews chapter 9, verses 24 to 28, as far as these comparisons with Aaron and then Christ. Now, concerning national Israel, it's pointing to the fact that when Christ comes again, Israel is to be brought back to God. And in an overall sense, the millennium is their day of atonement, where they're being brought back to God. It's not going to be an instantaneous thing. It's not going to be done just, here it's accomplished and they're at one with Christ, at one with the Father. But it's more like the whole millennium. It's like that's their day of atonement. And they'll keep moving more and more into it. And they'll be experiencing more and more with God. And you can note Zechariah chapter 12 and verse 10. Also in Zechariah chapter 14, verses 3, 4, 9, 20, and 21. 3, 4, 9, 20, and 21. He says at the end of chapter 16 here, in verse 29, it's the last paragraph of the chapter, "And this shall be a statute forever unto you, that in the seventh month, on the tenth day of the month, ye shall afflict your souls." The word afflict means to humble. They're going to humble themselves and do no work at all, whether it be one of your own country or a stranger that sojourneth among you. This is where they had to really open up to God. They had to acknowledge their need for God. They had to humble themselves before God. Verse 31, it says, "It shall be a Sabbath of rest unto you, and you shall afflict your souls by a statute forever." Now, one of the reasons it becomes a rest is because their sins have been forgiven. And then more and more, as our sins are really taken out of our lives, that produces more rest. The Day of Atonement is to produce rest, ceasing from our own labors. "Not my will, but thy will be done." He wants us to have peace. He wants us to have a rest in our souls. Sin always causes a storm. Quite a storm in the souls of men. So that's the Day of Atonement. We'll talk some more about it when we look at the actual feast days. That's what we'll look at when we start on chapter 23. Now, chapter 17 to 22, we find just a lot of different things. And all that I'm going to give you are kind of the general points of these chapters. And I'll give you some specific points, but most of it will be just in general. And so we'll go through it chapter by chapter, but very briefly. Chapter 17 is dealing with the place where sacrifices are made, which, of course, is the altar. And it also is dealing with the sanctity of the blood. It deals with the place of sacrifice as well as the sanctity of the blood. Verses 1 to 9 reveal the altar of sacrifice to be the only acceptable place of sacrifice. There is no other acceptable place. None. That's verses 1 to 9. He says in verse 7, chapter 17, verse 7, "And they shall no more offer their sacrifices unto devils, after whom they have gone a whoring. It shall be a statute forever unto them throughout their generations." This word for devils in the Hebrew means a hairy, rough he-goat. And there are, in a lot of heathen religions, you'll find where demons were worshipped under the figure of he-goats. So it's talking about, undoubtedly, some sort of offerings and sacrifices done to demonic things, done to demons. And he's showing, I think, things that maybe were still with them from Egypt, and also certain things that would become available to them through surrounding nations when they finally got into the land of Canaan. And he's just telling us that we need to stay away from, as it were, making sacrifices to demons. It's like the idea of sacrifice is making allowance for or surrendering to. And we need the Lord to show us what kind of things that, or we could be making allowance for something that really could be demonic. It could be like an area where we're surrendering to demonic power. And sometimes it's not real obvious. Sometimes it's very, very subtle. It doesn't mean they were doing it right now. But I think that God saw things that were out there in the future, things from the past. He was giving them a warning. He was just saying, now, this is what you use it for, and you don't use it for this. And I want you to keep this in mind. In other words, he doesn't want anything that is his, as it were, to be surrendered to demonic power, to be surrendered to demons. It's the same thing that he says in 1 John, where he says that they're to flee all idols. Don't have any idols. It's the very last statement of 1 John, talking about idols. And the people that he's talking to, they weren't idolatrous. They weren't worshiping idols. Idols aren't just big, fat, ugly Buddhas made out of stone or marble or some other thing. Idols are anything that keep us from God or take our attention away from God. And sometimes it can be something that at one point you could label as legitimate, just fine, no problem. But maybe it starts to demand more time, and now it's more in the category of an idol. It's actually working to separate one's heart from God. So there's a lot of different warnings in Scripture. They're safeguards. They're also spoken because God, by foreknowledge, sees the kind of things that are going to entice man, the kind of things that are going to be temptations. Now, verses 10 to 16 here in chapter 17 show that blood was to not be eaten under any circumstance. He shows that blood has one purpose, and that was to make atonement for souls. It has no other purpose. It's to make atonement. Verse 15, he says, "And every soul that eateth that which died of itself, or that which was torn with beasts, whether it be one of your own country or a stranger, he shall both wash his clothes and bathe himself in water, and be unclean until the evening. Then shall he be clean." Now the best explanation of what's happening here is that this was probably done unwittingly. The problem with eating this type of meat is that the blood would remain in it. You couldn't drain all the blood out. There would be, I don't know how much, but there is blood that remains because of this kind of death. And so they would be inadvertently eating blood. And so there'd be uncleanness because of eating that blood. They were to make sure that in no way had they profaned the blood. They were to treat the blood of the covenant in a very sanctified, sacred, sober manner. The blood is a very important thing here. And so that's what he's pointing out. You can connect with that Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews 10, verses 26 to 31. Hebrews 10, 26 to 31. Now, in chapter 18, the topic is unlawful marriages and unlawful lusts. Unlawful marriages, unlawful lusts. Verse 3 says, "After the doings of the land of Egypt, wherein ye dwelt, shall ye not do. And after the doings of the land of Canaan, whither I bring you, shall ye not do. Neither shall ye walk in their ordinances." He's showing that the world's pattern is not what we are to follow. We're not to follow that. You can compare 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 2 to 7. 1 Thessalonians 4, 2 to 7. In this chapter, he touches on incest. He also touches on other forms of immorality. He makes it very clear that these things are unacceptable. Very much unacceptable. The thing that I feel like we need to really understand in these type of things, though, is the power of demonic spirits. We're talking about really powerful spirits. And we do need to understand that. I'm not making an excuse for anybody, but I think a lot of these things that people end up doing, it's not them just being debauched. It's not, this guy's just a wreck. This guy's just perverted. We're talking about spirits that have made this person the way that he is. Because we're talking about a lot of very unnatural things. They're horrible. But I think we need, as best as possible, to be able to separate the demonic power from the person. It's pretty easy to have an extremely negative view of different kinds of people in their sins. I'll tell you, with that view, it's going to be awful hard to love them. It's going to be awful hard to reach out to them. They are at fault, and they need to repent. And they need to face their accountability. But What they really need is they need to be loved for who they are. They really need to be loved. They need to be accepted. And where people can see them without this power on them. And where you can talk to their heart. Because most of these people trapped in these kind of things, they don't want to be like that at all. They don't want to be like that. They don't know that they can be free. There is a power on them. A lot of them don't even know that there's a power on them. But there is a very powerful power, powerful demons. Verses 24 to 30 show them being cut off. He says, if you defile yourselves in any of these things, then they're going to be cut off. For in all these the nations are defiled, which I cast out before you. I cast these people out. And if you do what they have done, I will have to cast you out. And the land is defiled. Therefore I do visit the iniquity thereof upon it. And the land itself vomiteth out her inhabitants. Ye shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, and shall not commit any of these abominations, neither any of your own nations, nor any stranger that sojourns among you. And so he's giving them a warning. Very last verse, verse 30, therefore shall ye keep mine ordinance, that ye commit not any one of these abominable customs which were committed before you, and that ye defile not yourselves therein. I am the Lord your God. You can compare 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 1 to 6. And that's where there was a problem with incense, incest there in the Corinthian church. And it was having to be dealt with. And so it even you find these things carried over into the New Testament. You've got the same demons. Now in chapter 19, we find just some general admonitions. So he's covering a wide gamut of things. In this chapter, we find what properly can be called the key verse of the book of Leviticus. It's chapter, it's verse 2. So here in chapter 19, speak unto all the congregation of the children of Israel, and say unto them, ye shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. You can also note chapter 11, verse 45, which says the same thing. Luke chapter 1, verses 74 and 75. 2 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1. Hebrews 12, verse 14. And 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 11. Now, there are a number of things that are pointed out here that reveal God's holiness and how His likeness is to be revealed in us. Number one, these are just different things that are mentioned. We are to reverence those set by God over us. We are to reverence those that have been set over us by God. He also talks about the Sabbath, and so in order to really come into holiness, we have to cease from our own labors, and we must enter the Holy Spirit rest. Cease from our own labors and enter into the Holy Spirit rest. He also mentions idolatry. So to enter into holiness, we must turn from every type of idol. Turn from every type of idol. Also in this chapter, he talks about the peace offering. So it shows that we need to maintain full and proper communion and fellowship with God. So we're to reverence those set by God over us, cease from our own labors, turn from every type of idol, maintain full and proper communion and fellowship with God. It also shows that we are to be compassionate. It's showing that we're to not be a greedy people. That's shown in verses 9 and 10. Do not be greedy. It also shows that we are to deal fairly with God and man in every area and situation of life. We need to deal fairly in business matters, family matters, ministry matters, all sorts of things. Deal fairly. That is, we aren't to take advantage of anyone. It's summed up where he says that we are to love our neighbor as ourself. Don't take advantage of anyone. The Jews were well known historically for taking advantage of people. The way they would Jew one another in the marketplace, cleverly taking advantage of one another, and both walking away feeling like they'd taken advantage of the other one. So they were at least both happy when it was all done. Now, another thing is they were to keep unlike things separate. And this is where he talks about you're not to weave different materials together. And I think what his point is he's saying, I think he's saying this spiritually. He says, you can't serve two masters. You can't have unlike things. He also mentions how you can't have an ox and then some other kind of animal that you're going to have working together in the field. You can't have these different kinds of materials and sew them together. You can't have these different animals. They're not going to work right. So you can't serve two masters. It's also the idea of having believers and unbelievers. See, they can't have fellowship. They can't have communion together. It's also the wheat and the tares. See, they're different things. And I think that's possibly what he's making reference to. You can note Matthew 6, verse 24. Also chapter 13, verses 24 to 30. Chapter 13, verses 24 to 30. Also 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 14 to 17. 2 Corinthians 6, verses 14 to 17. And then in verses 20 to 22, he says this, "And whosoever lieth carnally with a woman, that is a bondmaid, betrothed to an husband, and not at all redeemed, her, nor freedom given her, she shall be scourged. They shall not be put to death, because she was not free. And he shall bring his trespass offering unto the Lord, under the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, even a ram for a trespass offering. And the priest shall make an atonement for him with the ram of the trespass offering before the Lord, for his sin which he hath done. And the sin which he hath done shall be forgiven him." So these verses involve improper sexual relations between a free man and a woman that is a slave who's been acquired for another man. You got a free man and you have a woman that is a slave, but she's been acquired for somebody else. She appears to be in a state of progressing toward full freedom. Now, if she had been free, then Deuteronomy chapter 22, verses 23 and 24 would have applied. Deuteronomy chapter 22, verses 23 and 24 would have applied, which say, "If a damsel that is a virgin be betrothed unto a husband, and a man find her in the city and lie with her, then ye shall bring them both out under the gate of that city, and ye shall stone them with stones, that they die. The damsel, because she cried not, being in the city, and the man, because he had humbled his neighbor's wife, so thou shalt put away evil from among you. So if she had been free, then they would have killed both of them. But because she was still a slave woman, even though betrothed to somebody else, she was scourged, and he had to make this trespass offering. Kyle and Delitzsch say this in their commentary. Even the personal rights of slaves were to be upheld. And a maid, though a slave, was not to be degraded to the condition of personal property. If anyone lay with a woman who was a slave, and she's betrothed to a man, but neither redeemed nor emancipated, that is, she hasn't been set free, the punishment of death was not to be inflicted, as in the case of adultery, and that's mentioned later in chapter 20, verse 10. Or the seduction of a free virgin who was betrothed because she was not set free. So the reason is she wasn't set free. But scourging was to be inflicted, and the guilty person was also to bring a trespass offering for the expiation of his sin against God. Here in the King James, it has the phrase, not at all redeemed. That refers to the fact that she had not been able to purchase her freedom. So she was still a slave. It appears she was scourged, and then he had to make the offering. So that's how it was dealt with. It also seems that he may have been the master of this slave. That's a good possibility. He may have been the owner of this slave. Now, to me, that makes this whole thing more real. If he owns this woman, he's the master, she's the slave, she is betrothed to somebody else, it makes the temptation more real, more understandable. It's not just like some guy just happens to come along and finds a slave girl and they have sexual relations. But if this man, he owns this woman, and a lot of these slaves were very, very attractive. We're not talking about born-again, spirit-filled Christians with loads of enlightenment and understanding. We're talking about Old Covenant saints, fresh out of Egypt, all sorts of things going on in Egypt, all sorts of things pulling on them. He owns this person. In effect, it'd be easy to think, well, I own her body, and she's my property. And that has happened just literally millions of times historically. And it's not right. It's not good. It's not acceptable. But it makes it much more understandable as to how it happened. It also, in my estimation, makes it more understandable why God didn't deal that severely. See, just for her to be scourged and he has to make this offering, that's dealing with it in kind of a... doesn't seem like he's treating it very seriously. Well, under the circumstances, see, God understands circumstances. God understands these situations. See, I'll tell you, God just does not deal with things like he has this little puny mind. And he only saw two factors, and he deals with it based on those two factors. God does not deal with people like that. God takes into consideration things that a lot of times we wouldn't even think to take into consideration. He's dealing with us so much differently than if man was God, and that man who's God was dealing with us, woe be unto us. It would be so simplistic. It would be so heartless. It would be literally so cruel. It would be horrible. God understands the situation and how that could then take undue advantage of the person. Really, he understands that. He acknowledges it. There's a lot of things that, if you went by the book, you'd just say, well, that was a horrible sin. How could you ever do that? But, see, if we really knew what was going on, and I'm not taking anything away from the fact that sin has been committed, but God just doesn't look at sin as sin. And the case is closed. Guilty? Yeah, he's guilty. You know, take him out and hang him. God is not like that. That's not God. Those are demons of condemnation and hopelessness and demons of defeat and all the rest. And it's still sin and has to be dealt with. But he understands how it happened, why it happened. God takes all of that into consideration. Demons don't. And they'll come and just barrage you in this horrible, merciless way when you slip up and get snared by something. I think we'd be amazed, though, and we are, when we finally hear God's voice speaking to us about that. He speaks a lot differently than those demons. He speaks a lot differently than Job's comforters. He speaks a lot differently than how the Pharisees wanted to treat that woman caught in adultery. Pretty amazing the way Jesus treated that woman. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing how tenderly he dealt with her. How much understanding he showed her. It's an amazing thing the way God deals with man. We could... let's see. Well, I think that's about all that we'll say about that. Verses 23 to 25. These verses deal with fruit on trees planted by Israel in the land of Canaan. We're dealing with everything here. This would cause Ed Hume's eyes to open up, you know, real wide. See what God has to say about flowers and plants. And so this is what you can use to win Ed Hume to the Lord. You have a chance to witness to him. Be sure to read these verses. I'm sure it'll bring him right into the kingdom. They were to leave the fruit on the trees for 3 years. And then the fruit of the fourth year was to be given as a praise offering to God. And then during the fifth year of there being fruit, the fruit was theirs. First 3 years, didn't do anything with it. Fourth year, gave it to God. Fifth year, it was theirs. And why exactly? I don't know. Maybe there's reasons physically, as far as God knows how to make a tree so it really produces loads of fruit. There might be certain spiritual truths involved somewhere in it. One thing is, he is putting them in a situation where they have to obey him. And he's saying, now this is what I want you to do. And it is interesting that it deals with trees. And when you go back to the Garden of Eden, there's a little problem there with the trees. And whether or not there's some sort of connection, I don't know. These are, to say the least, kind of difficult to deal with. We don't know all the reasons. I think that in these things, even though we can't tell all that well on some of it, I think the reasons were reasonable. I think they made sense. God is not just saying, now do this, and it's just to see if you'll be obedient. That is not the way God deals with man. There are reasons. There's definite reasons. Man doesn't always understand the reasons. But as God is able to communicate things and bring illumination and bring revelation, if he wants to and when he wants to, then people start to see, you really knew what you were doing. You really understood the situation. And I don't think they understood all the different things about clean and unclean meats. I don't think they understood some of these other types of things, although I do think in cases explanations were given where God did give them understanding. But other times, I don't think they really understood. I don't think in every single case they had full explanation, and therefore, because of the explanation, they would now do it. I think sometimes it just seemed like, well, we have to obey. But if we could get to where God is at and see the way God does, we'd find out there are reasons for it. It's not arbitrary. It's not some sort of a whim. God isn't telling people to do something in an arbitrary way or in some whimsical way. Now, verses 26 to 36 gives them just further regulations for godly living. And the very last verse, verse 37, says, therefore shall ye observe all my statutes and all my judgments and do them. The emphasis is on do them. James 1, verse 22, 1 John 2, verse 17, Revelation 22, verse 14. James 1, 22, 1 John 2, 17, Revelation 22, 14. Now, chapter 20 presents further directions for a proper life set apart unto God. It's showing that He is desirous for us to be fully His. He wants our full attention. And He doesn't want us serving idols. He doesn't want us to be out separated from Him. He wants us to be set apart unto Him. So it's dealing with, it mentions Molech. They weren't to offer their children to Molech. But we find in the book of Jeremiah, they're offering their children to Molech. They're making human sacrifices. That was part of their shedding innocent blood. He didn't want them to ever do that. That was never His will. Give your babies to alligators. All sorts of things that people have done. Hideous, horrible things. More like today, in a qualified sense. I suppose I probably really shouldn't say this, but in a qualified sense, it's like all these abortion clinics. That's what it comes down to. And I'm not saying all abortion is wrong, but the vast majority of these abortions are just, in one sense, they're horrible tragedies. But the one good thing is the fact that if those fetuses are counted as having a human soul, then all of those souls are going to heaven because there's no sin. A baby that dies in childbirth having no sin, where does that soul go? Has to go to heaven. It can't go to hell. It does not need the shed blood of Christ so that sin is removed. There is no sin. And, Don has dealt with these things on a number of occasions when you talk about the covering for the child, and you need a covering once the child has sinned. And if there isn't a godly parent or godly parents, then the child doesn't have a covering. That child dies after it's committed sin. It's got nothing to protect it. But a child that has sinned and has the covering of the parents until it comes to the age of accountability is protected by those parents. Well, if that child has no sin, it needs no covering. And to my mind, it shows the devil doing this horrible, hideous, just awful thing, because it's the devil, just doing this horrible thing to humanity. It's just a horrible thing. And it's far worse than probably any of us know, unless you've done reading about it and have found out some of the things that they've done. I mean, it's unbelievable the way some of these abortion clinics are run and what they do with the fetuses. And I mean, it's just a horrible thing. But if that fetus is counted as a living soul, there is a soul there formed, that soul goes to heaven. It has to go to heaven. Now, it doesn't end up in the bride. It doesn't end up in necessarily some high position with loads of treasures laid up on the other side. It's got no treasures laid up on the other side, but it doesn't go to hell. There's no way it can go to hell. There's no sin. There's nothing to be counted against that soul. And that, to me, shows how God can overturn the work of the devil and bring good out of horrible things. And that's what it says as far as my own estimation of it. Now, chapters 21 and 22 give some regulations concerning the priests. It's so that both their duties and their holiness might be maintained. So the regulations have a purpose, so that their duties and their holiness might be maintained. A general division for the two chapters would be in chapter 21, verses 1 to 15, there are certain prohibited practices that they cannot be involved with. Chapter 21, verses 1 to 15. From chapter 21, verse 16 through chapter 22, verse 16, it then gives prohibited persons, people that were prohibited from being priests. And then in chapter 22, verses 17 to 33, which concludes chapter 22, it gives prohibited offerings. So prohibited duties, prohibited persons, prohibited offerings. Here's some key points of typology in these two chapters. In chapter 21, verses 2 to 4, along with verses 10 to 12, 2 to 4, 10 to 12, it shows the high priest having a higher calling than the rest of the priests. And it shows Christ, who had a higher calling than you and I, or anyone else for that matter. He had the highest of all callings. He was called to do what no other man was called to do. And overall, he was called to live like no other man was called to live. It's the highest of all callings. It mentions in these verses being defiled for the dead. Defiled for the dead. This would occur if the priest assisted in laying out a dead body or in preparing it for burial. The defilement not only came by touching, but by coming into the place where the body was. Also by even touching the grave. And if he became defiled for the dead by touching the body, coming into the place where the body was, or by touching the grave, the result was 7 days of uncleanness. And this is also mentioned in Numbers chapter 19, verses 11 and 14. And during those 7 days, he was disqualified for tabernacle service. And he couldn't converse with other Israelites. See, he became ineffective in his ministry. Basically, he had no ministry for those 7 days. There is an exception given for the priests, but there is no exception for the high priest. Now, what this is emphasizing is proper priorities. It shows our first order of business is dealing with life, dealing with life-giving things. Not things that are tending toward death, which are outside the scope of the Father's business. Well, we'll talk more next time. Next time. When is next time? It's 2 weeks away. 22nd of October. We'll be getting real close to Halloween then. We'll have a show and tell, and you can show me what you're going to wear for Halloween.